Well, the IOTF was reconstituted fairly recently. I guess it was about a year ago, and it had been sitting idle for some time. We decided that now is the right time, since people are talking about moving on towards IPv6, since people have been worried about CIDR perhaps not working anymore, to examine the possibility of deploying something new, as well as supporting lots of other routing research. One of the things that came to our minds when considering what we would do new is, well, what should it be doing if we're inventing something new anyway? Is what we have sufficient? What are we using it for anyway? Are there new features that we can extract from a new routing paradigm? And we started asking ourselves and other people, well, what is it doing now? What are you hoping to use the routing system, particularly interdomain routing, for? And we got more answers than the people we asked. And some of the people didn't bother answering us. So one of the things that came to mind was the old fable of the blind man and the elephant, which is a poem that was done by John Godfrey Sachs. You can read it there yourselves. This was our problem. Go and study the routing system, given the fact that you can't see all of it all at once, or at all, depending on where you worked, depending on what you had access to in terms of information. So one of the people that we had talked to, and this is all an operator bias, the people who were application writers really, I didn't take track of, actually, frankly, to be quite honest. One of the things that I realized after having done the next set of slides was that there is no representation other than from providers. There's no end user comment saying, well, gee, we'd really like it to do XYZ. There's no application developer comment saying, well, we'd really like it to do XYZ. The assumption is, well, we just like it to work. The people who have really strong opinions on what the routing system should do are all providers or people who are multi-homing to the extent that they might as well be a provider. One of the most common answers we got were from people who are doing lots of content hosting. This was a sexy thing at the time about a year ago, before the current market changes. And one of the most common comments was, we really want to get our content out in a reliable and predictable fashion along the best possible path towards the people who are paying us to see it. We want to give them a good experience, which means that we need to be able to discover what the best path is from where my content happens to live to where the eyeballs are that are viewing it or the ears which are hearing it. I happen to be a backbone operator and have been for a few years. We had a couple of people who had strong opinions on that. Largely it had to do with improving customer experience so that they would pay us more money, being greedy capitalists. Among the issues that came up was that BGP is unnecessarily complicated when you're trying to get it to do relatively simple-seeming things, such as balancing traffic among several exchange points, keeping local traffic local so that you can avoid situations where traffic between someone in Stockholm and someone in Stockholm goes through California, and little issues like that. Some people had some really interesting ideas. These were the research crowd. Gee, we'd really like to have quality of service and other metrics well represented within the routing system. Well, we have one right now and it barely works. Having several in the current routing system isn't going to work. So this seemed like a really wild idea, sort of like turning an elephant into a jet plane just because it has wing-like structures on it. Some people wanted to have failovers within milliseconds. Some of us are friends with Peter Lothberg, who likes to say that, gee, 30 milliseconds is a pretty good target because that's what the phone company people do. Can't do that with the current system. Basically be able to scale and grow and cope with massive amounts of traffic growth, like we just saw in the previous presentation. Some people want a degree of versatility that isn't existing in the current system unless you really force it in. Building VPNs with BGP, building support for other protocols with BGP so that you have ships in the night mechanisms, building virtual circuits with MPLS comes to mind, supporting IPv6 comes to mind. And these are yet more issues with people wandering around and saying, gee, this is what we'd really like to have from the routing system. This is what we're using the routing system for now, and it's not working very well. One of the issues that came up is that the routing system that exists now is extremely insecure. There are known attacks, which are very scary and which are very difficult to prevent and difficult to fix once they're underway. The classic example, which is still pretty open flaw in the current model is that if you decided to go and attack the TCP connections over which BGP is being talked between two large enough providers, you could cause all the routers on the planet to do an awful lot of work, and some of them won't keep up, which spreads out, and at some point you're going to have routers engaging in looping and black hole behavior because they can't keep up with what the logical topology of the internet is at any given moment, given this massive flapping about between perhaps a UUNET and a Sprint. These denial of service attacks can be pretty devastating and are very difficult in the current model to fix. There's other denial of service attacks which can be just as devastating, if not as global. Somebody came along and said, I'd really like to introduce a prefix slightly longer than MIT's. It would probably be accepted by a lot of networks and would mean that MIT with its 18/8 prefix would see lots of user complaints. I can't get to here in the network, I can't get to there in the network. Tracking down who has introduced this is a little easier than with some denial of service attacks, but preventing it in the first place is not a tractable proposition with the mechanisms that we have available today. So stolen transit is one side effect that falls out of that particular denial of service attack. If I pretend to be a small piece of MIT and divert that traffic to me and replace bits of it strategically or monitor bits of it strategically, then I can steal information or even the identity of the people who are far away across the network from me. Stolen identity is a real issue and can make tracking down a flood attack originating from a victim prefix very difficult indeed. So there were lots of other comments and opinions on what the current routing system should do, what it's not doing well, and how it should look. And as with the poem, people stumble around saying, well, gee, it's really like a tree now, and it would be nice if it was more like a kite, or if it was more like a rope, or if it was more like a brick wall. There are these really sharp points and so forth. The parable of the blind man with the Indian is that they can never really agree on what the shape of an elephant really is. This is exactly what happens at NANOG and IETF. If you're on the mailing lists, this slide comes as absolutely no surprise to you. So we have roughly, these are correct elephants rather than distorted elephants. I have no skill with Photoshop, so I couldn't make it big ears. But essentially the problem is, how do we do any of this stuff that we'd really like to do in the current routing system? Can we lumber along as the big heavy elephant with the many nodes, the growing population, the growing complexity, and have it deal with yet more features which even today are not particularly well supported or well exploited in interdomain routing? Pushing the routing system harder is frankly risky. If we mess up, the elephant falls down on you, and they're very heavy things. Having a situation like what happened in the early 90s, the routing system falling apart for 5, 6 hours, 7 hours at a time, being completely unusable for any practical purposes, with black holes introduced, with loops introduced, with traffic going the wrong direction, basically the entire internet can suffer if we push too hard in the wrong places. So some people are very frightened by the idea of introducing a lot more information into the routing system, even relatively locally. Randy Bush has made several strong comments here and there that BGP VPN is a very bad idea to do in a large provider, because the large provider is already busy enough handling all of the internet's information. Introducing more information into the same protocols and trying to use the same control mechanism risks having a big piece of the internet simply fail to work. And well, as a competitor, I wouldn't mind seeing a very large network or two have a problem for a day or two. The problem is that my users wouldn't agree with that. They would like to have connectivity to them at all the time. Interdomain routing as it exists today is pretty primitive. It evolved out of RIP and then into something called RCP RootD, which you really don't want to know about, then into EGP, which is RIP with an extra attribute or two, and then into BGP to avoid, or rather to deal with, the situation which arose, which was that the NSFNet backbone was no longer the only center of the universe providing services to regional networks. The way BGP works really is roughly a lot like RIP. Jakob Rechter, who is one of the people who designed RIP on four napkins, really doesn't like me saying this, but the fact is that you introduce a prefix, you introduce now in BGP 4 classful prefixes, and you have a metric associated with them, and you have other attributes associated with the prefix to help you make a decision on whether you're going to accept something of metric X, which is some AS path long, or metric Y, which is some AS path longer. The advertising mechanism is roughly the same. So what you're stuck with is trying to deal with selecting or exploring the possibilities from a large set of what you could call trail of breadcrumbs in the AS path, or from a large set of comparably lengthed AS paths, which you could treat as a scalar metric. All of the policy in BGP really falls into these two categories here, constraining possible AS paths and constraining the association between AS paths and prefixes. That's all we're doing when we're doing filtering. That's all we're doing when we're doing route selection. The extra knobs such as communities are just simply tools to make this job somewhat easier. Policies, as a result, are pretty coarse-grained. You apply them on a prefix or you apply them on an AS path or a fraction of the AS path. And policy is therefore really applied only locally. You apply it at a border between provider A and provider B. However, when you're doing this, you can introduce some alarming side effects into the global network. This is about growth. Basically, the internet is growing. The amount of information that you expect to see in the routing tables will grow with the population of the network, both in terms of number of users, because more users means more address space consumption, means more prefixes, the way things are allocated now. More companies entering into the market to provide services to these users also means more prefixes, simply because people choose to multi-home, and the way we do multi-homing now really tends to introduce a lot more prefixes than could be done otherwise in a different paradigm. As Harold said in his presentation, we also have issues with respect to simple lazy bad configuration, and we also have more generously traffic engineering, which some people believe in and some people are rather skeptical of. These are introducing long prefixes to try to influence the behavior of remote networks, because the rule in BGP route selection or path selection is that you always choose the longest possible prefix to follow before anything else. It's the trump card that wins all decisions. The growth in the number of prefixes in the global tables or in local tables have a cost. You have to invest more in terms of equipment. You have more resource consumption. You have to deal with the possibility of or the likelihood of slower convergence. More on that in a second. And you also have greater complexity. Oops. BGP and RIP. Well, BGP is actually worse than RIP, and Yakov hates this slide even more. Essentially, with RIP, you have the problem of counting to infinity. RIP solves the problem by declaring infinity to be a number around the range of 32. So if A, B, and C are talking with one another, and one link goes down in this triangle, the others argue about who has the better path to the one furthest away, and at some point you count, oh, I have a value of 3, oh, I have a value of 4, oh, I have a value of 5, and so on and so forth. You eventually hit infinity and converge. BGP doesn't stop counting at 32. It also has the problem that it really isn't a scalar metric like it is with RIP. It's an interesting AS path with lots of components in it which can reorder. In the worst case, for trying to explore the metrics which are available in RIP, you have 1 to N. In the worst case, in exploring the metrics or the alternative paths which are available to you in the case of failure of BGP, you have rather worse, N factorial. And here's an example of what happens when N is 4. You can choose any 4 providers and have a link between 2 of them fail. And this is the possibilities that will get walked through. In practice, it isn't this bad because you have timeouts, you have issues with respect to timers in terms of hold downs, you have the amount of time it takes to process information in, you have queuing effects in TCP and other issues with respect to transport and so forth, which tend to eliminate the chatter that would be involved if you were trying to explore all of these. However, there are situations which can exist, not only in theory but also in practice, which will cause exactly this to happen. And this has been observed, and it's very scary. because n equals 4 is a rather small AS path for some people who are looking at things far away from them. As I noted earlier, BGP solved the RIP announcement problem in a really interesting way. It seemed to make sense at the time because you avoided loops. You were guaranteed to reach a situation in which you could not form loops because of the way advertising is passed around. The problem is that you don't need to have actual announcement loops in order to observe bad behavior in the event of failures or changes in prefix information. This was research done by my co-chair, Abba Ahuja, and some of her colleagues into a view over many months of how convergence actually works in the real world. They took several views and several providers and recorded time-stamped information about when they heard announcements, withdrawals, fallovers from a short set of ASs in an AS path to a longer set of ASs in an AS path, and vice versa. And again, these are very S-shaped distributions. The tails are extremely long, so we cut it off at 160 or 180 seconds. This is a long time to converge. This isn't the 30 millisecond target that some people would like to meet with BGP. Yes, you can probably do this with something like IS to IS with a limited number of links, but for interdomain stuff right now, you say something less than 30 seconds and people will look at you funny. Indeed, what you see here is that a change in terms of introducing a new route or improving a route by having a shorter AS path suddenly become available is quite a lot faster than failing over and having a change from a relatively short AS path to something longer as a result of a failure. And worst is what happens in terms of convergence in the case that a prefix actually goes away because the source is no longer able to advertise it or generate it at all. As noted, up to 15 minutes has been observed. I expect that if you looked for a long enough period of time, you would see even longer periods before convergence happens, simply because you have issues with respect to AS path and change damping and other effects which exist in terms of timers. During the convergence of any of these events, you're at risk for seeing black holes, which is that you forward in to a router which is claiming that it has the right next hop, but it doesn't have a next hop that's valid at all, forwarding into a deadline or something along those lines. Then you have loops, which is two routers neighboring one another, or worst case, several routers in concert, all pointing at one another, and packets go around in circles until they time out. And the trend is worsening. This is your single view of the internet from a site in California, which sits in the middle about here. This is exploring, or rather mapping out in a two-dimensional fashion, the connectivity among all of the ASs in all of the AS paths that they see. So basically, this is a very simple squashing down of a much more complicated structure. There's no geography involved in this. There's no association by provider. Any two points connected by a line are two ASs. So at the edges, you have a whole bunch of ASs. There are 30-some-odd thousand of them in this table that was analyzed. And here you'd have a provider of some of these and a provider of some of these and so on and so forth. And you get towards the very large providers in clumps here. You can guess who that is, the biggest one. This is one view. Everyone's view is going to be very different from this, simply because you have a filtering effect in terms of BGP information because you only announce the routes which you are choosing to use. So some of the things that are visible in this map would simply be invisible elsewhere. Likewise, some things are missing from this map that would be visible elsewhere. The picture that you would get from an exploration like this done from within a backbone provider is very different than you would get from within a Leaf user. The other thing that is interesting about this is that this is a snapshot picture. If you watch this over time and could animate it, the structure would change rather dramatically as lines failed here and there, as new providers came online, as new users came online and started doing their own multi-homing and so forth. So this static picture is a very, very surface presentation of real complexity in terms of analyzing what BGP is doing. With respect to greater costs as opposed to greater complexity, you have the issue, as Harold mentioned, is that while modern routers can do it, there's a desire to retain modern readers for a while rather than replacing them every couple months or every 6 months or so. It becomes a very expensive habit when you're talking about millions of dollars worth of equipment per box. The issue isn't so much memory these days as it was in 1993 through 1995. The issue is now that, well, yeah, you can acquire gigabytes of memory. It's available in supermarkets in California for relatively cheap prices. It's just that now, rather than having one copy of the table, you might have a copy of the table per line card and a 16-line card box. That's 16 gigabytes of memory. Okay, maybe that's not so much, but then you also have to figure out how you get information from one chunk of 1 gigabyte worth of reading table to another chunk of 1 gigabyte worth of reading table so that they're coordinated and have a consistent view. It turns out that the thing that worries people right now is the amount of CPU processing time needed to synchronize these tables to process information that comes in via BGP and other reading tables to form a consistent centralized table and to have the forwarding cards and other dynamic equipment be able to extract information from these repositories and start forwarding along them. If growth continues in a constrained fashion, in such a way that Moore's law is the winner rather than growth in terms of the dynamicism of the reading table as well as the number of prefixes, interlinked issues, then we're okay. And as Harold notes, we're probably fine. The readers will just cope. It might be more expensive in 1 year. It might be less expensive in another year, depending on how growth is doing in CPU power and so forth versus the internet. However, if we start seeing growth return to exponential, which is Harold's tornado market, then unless somebody does something very, very clever with semiconductors, we're in a lot of trouble. Oops, sorry, too far. This is relatively old data. I took it because somebody else had done it, and I'm lazy. This is a comparison of the growth in the number of prefixes versus a growth in the number of roots which are seen. This was designed initially to scare people into realizing that the exploration of ASPaths in an unconstrained manner is an NP-complete problem. In a constrained fashion, which is what we have now, it's merely NP-hard. So this line trending upwards, and it continues upwards on a very different slope than this line, even as we extend it into the future, and I hope that the work which has been done on this is published very soon, it's really quite worrying. It means that As the spread between these two lines increases, the amount of time it takes to converge for the set of prefixes increases in proportion to that line, not in proportion to this line. The amount of storage increases in proportion to this line. The amount of processing time that you need to do to bring in BGP information, process it, apply policy to it, and send it out is in proportion to this black line. But the amount of time necessary to actually fix yourself on a consistent view where all the readers are cooperating such that you're avoiding black holes and loops is in proportion to the red line. And with the red line continuing to grow as people multi-home, this is a scary prospect. This is a slide which unfortunately you just lost the surprise of. Some of you have seen it at IETFs and so on and so forth. This is Harold's exponential line followed by a cap. We don't know how to go beyond the cap. The cap is somewhere in the future. But don't panic. We don't have a mechanism right now which will actually cope with exponential scaling. We are stuck with mechanisms that would even provide a superset of what we're able to do with the reading system now in terms of extra dynamicism, in terms of extra policy, in terms of multi-protocol support in a sensible way, and so forth. There are known problems which exist, and we don't have real solutions for them right now. What we have is band-aids that we can cobble together so that we have enough time to arrive at a system where these are no longer problems. So one of the band-aids is rationing. We've already long since introduced the idea of rationing the amount of address space that anybody is given. The write processes are familiar to the people who are operators in the room. Essentially, you end up having to justify the allocations that you get based on actual utilization rather than on some marketing plan or on simply I'm big and I can afford it or what have you. we also have a degree of rationing which have been introduced by providers themselves trying to protect their networks. Some of us are using a prefix dampening mechanism, which we've described in a write document. I believe it's 121, however, quote me on that in email. We also have some providers, at least two that are known of, that are doing prefix length filtering on a relatively small number of bits. 19 seems to be the value. We also have a much larger number of providers who are doing prefix length filtering on a relatively long set of bits. 24 is very common. I think that you would be very hard-pressed to find very many large-scale providers which are allowing prefixes longer than slash 24 into their networks at all. An analysis done by Randy Bush and Steve Bellevin at AT&T indicated that most of the things that were longer than slash 24 appeared to be mistakes anyway. If you threw them away, there was very little unreachability or worsening of reachability introduced. So that's one way of trying to cope with scale, is that you limit the amount of information that you can carry by introducing rationing on it. Therefore, you're not going to hit that horizontal line and keel over dead in a way that newspapers are going to take note of. However, it does introduce some degree of pain. Rationing is never very fun for people. You have to start taking that into account along with other things. We also have seen the development of tools which make coping with a rationing environment somewhat easier. NAT, DHCP, some renumbering tools which are done for ad hoc purposes, are all really targeted towards reducing the amount of address space being consumed, so that hosts which are not in general going to use the internet at all don't actually have to use an address which is visible across the entire internet. It's really a compression mechanism which allows a network to use fewer number of external addresses which are visible to the world, and they have internal things talking over a long period of time. There's also ways of using the same technology to multi-home between two providers. If you have a NAT box with provider address A and provider address B, and you do DNS magic or other tricks so that you're attracting traffic into a host with a NAT 10 address, for example, you can manage to give yourself some degree of multi-homing without introducing extra prefixes into the internet. That is, that you're using addresses from provider A and provider B, which those providers simply aggregate and don't de-aggregate to anyone else. This technology is evolving. It's not perfect. There are problems with it. There are religious issues with NAT in general. But with resource rationing likely to exist in the absence of technology does not yet exist, this kind of technology is quite likely to evolve. One of the other things that I deal with is in the ITF, I co-chair the IPv6 multi-homing, site multi-homing working group, and we're trying to explore ways of dealing with multi-homing sites, which are corporations, end-user sites, and so forth, who are trying to home to multiple providers. There is right now no way of doing this other than using the IPv4 approach. There are lots of ways which are being discussed which could be used instead. IPv6 has an advantage in that because there's so many addresses, the NAT trick of using double the amount of addresses, some from provider A and some provider B, so that you can have some number of hosts inside using addresses from C, connect to the rest of the internet through one or the other without de-aggregating provider A's address or provider B's address. In IPv6, hosts are expected to be able to deal sensibly with having multiple addresses, some from provider A, some from provider B. So the idea is that without doing NAT itself, you should be able to do the trick of NAT multi-homing. You just simply use more addresses. Because IPv6 has lots of addresses, this shouldn't be a problem. It's a convincing argument. It's just that simply the technology to actually take advantage of this property hasn't actually been properly done yet, and is still really, unfortunately, under discussion stage rather than under deployment stage. There are some other tricks which can be explored with IPv6, and I'll get into those in a moment. What else are we missing? The real problem, though, is that unless we have something other than the IPv4 approach to CIDR multi-homing, which is you introduce ever longer prefixes, although IPv6 starts with an advantage in that because it has no installed base who had been given it a whole bunch of classful addresses, most of which weren't aggregatable at all, there's no swap. But this sort of pushes off exactly the problem of more and more prefixes as more and more entities multi-home. Finally, IPv6 will let us maybe explore other paradigms, and several of them exist. Most of them have to do with exchanging maps. Most of them require a change to the semantics of the way we're doing CIDR-like addresses. So while the number of extra bits in IPv6 is quite useful for exploring new routing paradigms, the extra bits themselves are insufficient if you're retaining exactly the same semantics, which is that address XYZ/128 is A, globally unique, B, is going to remain the same from the sender to receiver and at all points in between when a packet is in flight, is not conducive to being able to deal with some really interesting ideas for doing multi-homing, for doing new routing paradigms. And really, the principal requirement for most of these new ideas is a separation from, or a separation between the identity of what it is that is sending or receiving traffic, whether it's an application or a host, and its location in the network in terms of where it's connected into the topology. So addresses in the CIDR mechanism, whether they're for V4 or V6, are overloaded. Your address not only tells the routers where you are, so they can forward traffic towards you, they also are an indication of who you are in terms of what your host is. So a lot of applications expect that their counterpart is going to have one IP address. It's going to stay the same for some period of time. So when you do a DNS lookup, you're allowed to cache the result. When you are sending information in band, you're allowed to use the IP address in its entirety to identify who you are to the other provider so that you can do things like filtering policies and so on and so forth. This is a useful property of the end-to-end model. However, it goes way overboard, particularly in IPv6. One argument which was advanced is that you could separate the location piece, which is what the routers use, and the identity piece, which is what the applications use, by dividing the syntax, the 128 bits, into two lumps of 64 bits. One set of bits would be used by the routers and not by applications. One set would be used by the applications and not the routers. So what would happen is that the applications and the host stacks and so on and so forth would then have to do such things as when doing a header checksum or a TCP pseudo header or a checksum over a TCP segment and so on and so forth, specifically not count the router bytes because they might be challenged or might be, sorry, adjusted in flight. However, the lower half, the application targeted 8 bytes, would remain the same end to end. That is, the sender would send out a pattern of 8 bytes, the receiver would see those 8 bytes, there would be no need to molest them along the way. This is a bit of a compromise. It's not particularly beautiful, but it allows us to leverage on a lot of IPv6 work. So you're not throwing out the baby with the bathwater when you decide that you're going to change header semantics. You can keep the syntax, you can keep a lot of the things which work with the syntax, but now you're dealing with a new feature by imposing new semantics on the address. Now, this is going to be interesting politically. There are some people who think this is a really neat idea and quite practical. There are some people who think that the entire address should be end-to-end and routers have no business going and coloring anything in the header at all. There are people who say, well, we can probably do this, but we don't understand what we do with it. And to be quite honest, that's true. What you're stuck with right now is along the lines of what we would be doing with NAT, with the exception that some chunk of the address would remain the same globally. Some practical advice in the meantime when we're struggling with these issues, and again, we have no really strong solutions, but there's no point in shooting ourselves in the foot by insisting on doing things in exactly the IPv4 fashion that we've been used to and trying to deal with it later when, with a little bit of effort and not too much pain, we can make it possible to explore several possibilities that involve a change to the semantics of the IPv4 or IPv6 or both addresses. One is, don't use IP addresses, use the DNS as much as possible. Yes, the DNS is slow. You have to do a lot of lookups. It's probably not the most efficient way of translating between a globally unique identifier, foo.bar.baz.com, and a locator, which is whatever your IP address happens to be. However, it's the only one that we have which we know how to operate on a large scale. It's a good distributed database. One thing that needs to be remembered is that the result you get from an A record lookup, your IP address is a location, not an identity. And one of the issues with respect to trying to treat it as an identity is that it could change. It could be shared with something that has a completely different identity. It could be shared with something that has a completely different identity either at the same time or later on as hosts move around or networks are plugged in from one network to another. So something else can move into the location, or it could be that the IP address that you've memorized is the host that you want to talk to is suddenly changed because that host has changed and moved somewhere and renumbered. And if you're trying to use that IP address, you could end up either talking to nothing or talking to something new that's wrong. So you really want to identify your correspondence using something other than your addresses. The only global hierarchical that is, and hierarchy is important to constrain the problem of doing lookups, mechanism that we have for assigning unique identifiers to things, whether they're applications or hosts, is the DNS. The DNS is convenient because it exists now, because we have ideas on how to scale it in terms of making it a little more secure than it is now, in terms of making it a little more dynamic than it is now, in terms of keeping it up to date with changes to the location of the thing which is identified in the DNS. Using the DNS name instead of a 32-bit or 128-bit IP address is simply good, sensible, defensive programming behavior for application writers. It also avoids the problem of trying to remember too many funny numbers. Again, this is an example. WS1.foo.bar.com might end up having a service SMTP living at a different IP address than a service HTTP. Unfortunately, that can't work today because we're really not doing routing based on, or rather lookups in the DNS based on what the service is. There is an RFC, and the number escapes me right now, done by Paul Vixie, which actually goes and suggests doing a lookup along the lines of SMTP, TCP, foo.bar.com, and you get back one A record. If you do http.tcp.foo.bar.com, you get back another A record. I think this is quite sensible. It allows you to develop either NAT technology or migration technology in really interesting ways without trying to lean upon making the routing system deal with it. The HTTP mechanism is really interesting. One of the side effects of having lots and lots and lots of address space in IPv6 is that you could, in principle, have one IP address per www.x.y.z, whereas right now you tend to have several www.x.y.z's all sharing one IP address, and you use in-band information within the HTTP conversation to determine who it is that you're talking to. So when you open up a connection to a web server, you tell it what the URL you're looking for is, and it will give you up the right content based on that. Even if you connect to the same IP address for foo.bar.com or for foo.deck.com. This is a really neat property of separating location and identity. It just happens that the identity is carried in-band within a protocol and thus has some limits. It's only useful for a connection-oriented conversation where you're keying off a DNS name. Having a formal separation done much lower in your TCP, in your stack, in your network stack, is a very sensible way of trying to exploit this for more and more protocols. Another good piece of advice that I give, or at least I think it's a good piece of advice, some people don't, is that you assume the existence of NAT and other things that you may or may not like in the network and try to adapt to the fact that your idea of what your correspondence address is may be different from its idea. Likewise, its idea of who you are could be very different from what your idea is. The classic example of where this breaks down is if you're trying to do SNMP, and you believe you're talking to something that believes it's using NET10 addresses, and you believe it's using something that is in real honest to God rooted IP address space, you could end up getting surprising answers back and make wrong decisions based on the responses to your SNMP queries. If you end up overloading location and identity and end up in a situation where the network mutates your address, you're overloading your overloaded prefix, your overloaded address, then you end up in failure modes. And this is exactly why NAT breaks down so often for so many protocols. IP addresses are really heavily used for things other than just simply finding the location of where you are in the network so that routers can get traffic towards you. They're also used as an identifier. They're used as a caching mechanism for reaching things that you want to get to. And then finally, being conservative in terms of what you announce to the internet, whether you're an operator or a multi-homed entity that isn't an operator, such as a corporation and so forth, being conservative in what you announce is very important. Use aggregatable addresses as much as possible. Avoid blowing holes in people's CIDR prefixes. Renumber. It's a good thing for everybody else, even if it's a bit of a pain for you with current technology. At the risk of having things thrown at me, use NAT where you can use NAT. Some people really don't mind missing the protocols that don't work well with NAT. And operator or non-operator, please be careful in terms of the amount of noise you introduce into the network when there are local topology changes. All operators should be running some degree of flap dampening. It's really good for everybody, and you'll notice a difference yourself when you start looking at the CPU levels in your non-border routers. And that's it.